disease-enabling, or vice versa? What if disease-causing gene variants were also genius-enabling? McKusick, for one, was convinced that overdeterminism in genetics and its indiscriminate application to human selection would result in the creation of what he called the genetic commercial complex. Near the end of his terms of office, President Eisenhower warned against the dangers of the military-industrial complex, McKusick said. It is appropriate to warn of a potential hazard of the genetic commercial complex. The increasing availability of tests for presumed genetic quality or poor quality could lead the commercial sector and the Madison Avenue publicist to bring subtle or not-so-subtle pressure on couples to make value judgments in the choice of their gametes for reproduction. In 1976, McKusick's concerns still seemed largely theoretical. Although the list of human diseases influenced by genes had grown exponentially, most of the actual genes were yet to be identified. Gene cloning and gene sequencing technologies, both invented in the late 1970s, made it conceivable that such genes could be successfully identified in humans, leading to predictive diagnostic tests. But the human genome has 3 billion base pairs, while a typical disease-linked gene mutation might result in the alteration of just one base pair in the genome. Cloning and sequencing all genes in the genome to find that mutation was inconceivable. To find a disease-linked gene, the gene would need to be somehow mapped or localized to a smaller part of the genome. But that, precisely, was the missing piece of technology. Although genes that cause diseases seemed abundant, there was no easy way to find them in the vast expanse of the human genome. As one geneticist described it, human genetics was stuck in the ultimate needle-in-a-haystack problem. A chance meeting in 1978 would offer a solution to the needle-in-a-haystack problem of human genetics, enabling geneticists to map and clone human disease-linked genes. The meeting, and the discovery that followed it, would mark one of the turning points in the study of the human genome. A Village of Dancers, An Atlas of Moles. In 1978, two geneticists, David Botstein from MIT and Ron Davis from Stanford, traveled to Salt Lake City to serve on a graduate review committee for the University of Utah. The meeting was held at Alta, high on the Wasatch Mountains, a few miles from the city. Botstein and Davis sat through the presentations, taking notes, but one talk struck a particular chord with both of them. A graduate student, Kerry Kravitz, and his advisor, Mark Skolnick, were painstakingly mapping the inheritance of a gene that causes hemochromatosis, a hereditary illness. Known by physicians since antiquity, hemochromatosis is caused by a mutation in a gene that regulates iron absorption from the intestines. Patients with hemochromatosis absorb enormous amounts of iron, resulting in a body that is slowly choked by iron deposits. The liver asphyxiates on iron, the pancreas stops working, the skin turns bronze and then ashen gray. Organ by organ, the body transforms into mineral, like the Tin Man and the Wizard of Oz, ultimately leading to tissue degeneration, organ failure, and death. The problem that Kravitz and Skolnick had decided to solve concerned a fundamental conceptual gap in genetics. By the mid-1970s, thousands of genetic diseases had been identified, hemochromatosis, hemophilia, and sickle cell anemia among them. Yet discovering the genetic nature of an illness is not the same as identifying the actual gene that causes that illness. The pattern of inheritance of hemochromatosis, for instance, clearly suggests that a single gene governs the disease and that the mutation is recessive. That is, two defective copies of the gene, one from each parent, are necessary to cause the illness. But the pattern of inheritance tells us nothing about what the hemochromatosis gene is or what it does. Kravitz and Skolnick proposed an ingenious solution to identify the hemochromatosis gene. The first step to finding a gene is to map it to a particular chromosomal location. Once a gene has been physically located on a particular stretch of a chromosome, standard cloning techniques can be used to isolate the gene, sequence it, and test its function. To map the hemochromatosis gene, Kravitz and Skolnick reasoned, they would use the one property that all genes possess. They are linked to each other on chromosomes. Consider the following thought experiment. Say the hemochromatosis gene sits on chromosome 7, and the gene that governs hair texture straight versus kinked or curly or wavy, is its immediate neighbor on the same chromosome. Now, assume that somewhere in distant evolutionary history, the defective hemochromatosis gene arose in a man with curly hair. Every time this ancestral gene is passed from parent to child, the curly-haired gene travels with it. Both are bound on the same chromosome, and since chromosomes rarely splinter, the two gene variants inevitably associate with each other. The association may not be obvious in a single generation, but over multiple generations, a statistical pattern begins to emerge. Curly-haired children in this family tend to have hemochromatosis. Kravitz and Skolnick had used this logic to their advantage. By studying Mormons in Utah with cascading, many-branched family trees, they had discovered that the hemochromatosis gene was genetically linked to an immune response gene that exists in hundreds of variants. Prior work had mapped the immune response gene to chromosome 6, and so the hemochromatosis gene had to be located on that chromosome. Careful listeners might object that this example was loaded. The gene for hemochromatosis happened to be conveniently linked to an easily identifiable, highly variant trait on the same chromosome. But surely such traits were fleetingly rare. That Skolnick's gene of interest happened to be sitting cheek by jowl with a gene that encoded an immune response protein that existed in many easily detectable variants was surely a lucky aberration. To achieve this kind of mapping for any other gene, wouldn't the human genome have to be littered with strings of variable, easily identifiable markers, lamplit signposts planted conveniently along every mile of chromosome? But Botstein knew that such signposts might exist. Over centuries of evolution, the human genome has diverged enough to create thousands of minute variations in DNA sequence. These variants are called polymorphisms, many forms, and they are exactly like alleles or variants, except they need not be in genes themselves. They might exist in the long stretches of DNA between genes or in introns. These variants can be imagined as molecular versions of eye or skin color, existing in thousands of varied forms in the human population. One family might carry an ACAAGTCC at a particular location on a chromosome, while another might have AGAAGTCC at that same location, a one base pair difference. Unlike hair color or the immune response, these variants are invisible to the human eye. The variations need not enable a change in phenotype or even alter a function of a gene. They cannot be distinguished using standard biological or physical traits, but they can be discerned using subtle molecular techniques. A DNA-cutting enzyme that recognizes ACAAG but not AGAAG, for instance, might discriminate one sequence variant and not the other. When Botstein and Davis had first discovered DNA polymorphisms in yeast and bacterial genomes in the 1970s, they had not known what to make of them. At the same time, they had also identified a few such polymorphisms scattered across human genomes, but the extent and location of such variations in humans was still unknown. The poet Louis MacNeice once wrote about feeling the drunkenness of things being various. The thought of tiny molecular variations peppered randomly through the genome, like freckles across a body, might have provoked a certain pleasure in a drunken human geneticist, but it was hard to imagine how this information might be useful. Perhaps the phenomenon was perfectly beautiful and perfectly useless, a map of freckles. But as Botstein listened to Kravitz that morning in Utah, he was struck by a compelling idea. If such variant genetic signposts existed in the human genome, then by linking a genetic trait to one such variant, any gene could be mapped to an approximate chromosomal location. A map of genetic freckles was not useless at all. It could be deployed to chart the basic anatomy of genes. The polymorphisms would act like an internal GPS system for the genome. A gene's location could be pinpointed by its association or linkage to one such variant. By lunchtime, Botstein was nearly frantic with excitement. Skolnick had spent more than a decade hunting down the immune response marker to map the hemochromatosis gene. "We can give you markers, markers spread all over the genome," he told Skolnick. The real key to human gene mapping, Botstein had realized, was not finding the gene, but finding the humans. If a large enough family bearing a genetic trait, any trait, could be found, and if that trait could be correlated with any of the variant markers spread across the genome, then gene mapping would become a trivial task. If all of the members of a family affected by cystic fibrosis inevitably co-inherited some variant DNA marker, call it variant X, located on the tip of chromosome 7, then the cystic fibrosis gene had to sit in proximity to this location. Botstein, Davis, and Skolnick published their idea about gene mapping in the American Journal of Human Genetics in 1980. "We describe a new basis for the construction of a genetic map of the human genome," Botstein wrote. It was an odd study, tucked into the middle pages of a relatively obscure journal and festooned with statistical data and mathematical equations, reminiscent of Mendel's classic paper. It would take some time for the full implication of the idea to sink in. The crucial insights of genetics, I said before, are always transitions, from statistical traits to inheritable units, from genes to DNA. Botstein had also made a crucial conceptual transition between human genes as inherited biological characteristics and their physical maps on chromosomes. Nancy Wexler, a psychologist, heard about Botstein's gene mapping proposal in the fall of 1979. She had a poignant reason to pay attention. In the summer of 1967, when Wexler was 22, her mother, Leonore Wexler, was stopped by a policeman for driving erratically through the streets of Los Angeles. She was not drunk. Leonore had suffered inexplicable bouts of depression, sudden mood swings, bizarre behavioral changes, and had attempted suicide once, but had never been considered physically ill. Two of Leonore's brothers, Paul and Seymour, once members of a swing band in New York, had been diagnosed with a rare genetic syndrome called Huntington's disease in the 1950s. Another brother, Jesse, a salesman who liked to perform magic tricks, had found his fingers dancing uncontrollably during his performances. He too was diagnosed with the same illness. Their father, Alfred Sabin, had died of Huntington's disease in 1926, but Leonore had assumed that she had been spared. By the time she saw a neurologist that winter in 1967, spasmodic twitches and dancing movements had begun to appear. She was also diagnosed with the disease. Named after the Long Island doctor who first described the condition in the 1870s, Huntington's disease was once called Huntington's chorea, chorea from the Greek word for dance. The dance, of course, is the opposite of dance, a joyless and pathological caricature, the ominous manifestation of dysregulated brain function. Typically, patients who inherit the dominant Huntington's gene, only one copy is sufficient to precipitate the disease, are neurologically intact for the first 3 or 4 decades of their life. They might experience occasional mood swings or subtle signs of social withdrawal, then minor, barely discernible twitches appear. Objects become hard to grasp. Wine glasses and watches slip between fingers and movements dissolve into jerks and spasms. Finally, the involuntary dance begins as if set to devil's music. The hands and legs move of their own accord, tracing, writhing, arc-like gestures separated by staccato rhythmic jolts, like watching a giant puppet show jerked by an unseen puppeteer. The late stage of the disease is marked by deep cognitive decline and near complete loss of motor function. Patients die of malnourishment, dementia, and infections, yet dancing to the last. Part of the macabre denouement of Huntington's is the late onset of the illness. Those carrying the gene only discover their fate in their 30s or 40s, that is, after they have had their own children. The disease thus persists in human populations by writhing its way past evolution's grasp. The gene is passed on to the next generation before it can be eliminated through natural selection. Since every patient with Huntington's disease has one normal copy and one mutant copy of the gene, every child born to him or her has a 50-50 chance of being affected. For these children, life devolves into a grim roulette, a waiting game for the onset of symptoms, as a geneticist described it. One patient wrote about the strange terror of this limbo. "I don't know the point where the gray zone ends and a much darker fate awaits, so I play the terrible waiting game, wondering about the onset and the impact." Milton Wexler, Nancy's father, a psychiatrist in Los Angeles, broke the news of their mother's diagnosis to his two daughters in 1968. Nancy and Alice were still asymptomatic, but they each carried a 50% chance of being affected, with no genetic test for the disease. Each one of you has a 1 in 2 chance of getting the disease, Milton Wexler told his daughters. And if you get it, your kids have a 1 in 2 chance of getting it. We were all hanging on to each other and sobbing, Nancy Wexler recalled. The passivity of just waiting for this to come and kill me was unbearable. That year, Milton Wexler launched a nonprofit institute called the Hereditary Disease Foundation, dedicated to funding research on Huntington's chorea and other rare inherited diseases. Finding the Huntington's gene, Wexler reasoned, would be the first step toward diagnosis, future treatments, and cures. It would give his daughters a chance to predict and plan for their future illness. Lenore Wexler, meanwhile, gradually descended into the chasm of her disease. Her speech began to slur uncontrollably. New shoes would wear out the moment you put them on her feet, her daughter recalled. In one nursing home, she sat in a chair in the narrow space between her bed and the wall. No matter where the chair was put, the force of her continual movements edged it against the wall until her head began bashing into the plaster. We tried to keep her weight up. For some unknown reason, people with Huntington's disease do better when they are heavy, although their constant motion makes them thin. Once she polished off a pound of Turkish delight in half an hour with a grin of mischievous delight, but she never gained weight. I gained weight. I ate to keep her company. I ate to keep from crying. Leonore died on May 14, 1978. 17 months later, in October 1979, Nancy attended a genetics workshop in Washington where she heard about Botstein's gene mapping technique. The method was still largely theoretical. Thus far, no human gene had been successfully mapped with it, and the likelihood of using the method to map the Huntington's gene was remote. Botstein's technique was, after all, crucially dependent on the association between a disease and markers. The more patients, the stronger the association, the more refined the genetic map. Huntington's chorea, with only a few thousand patients scattered across the United States, seemed perfectly mismatched to this gene mapping technique. Yet Nancy Wexler could not shake the image of gene maps from her mind. A few years earlier, Milton Wexler had heard from a Venezuelan neurologist of two neighboring villages, Barranquitas and Lagunetas, on the shores of Lake Maracaibo in Venezuela, with a striking prevalence of Huntington's disease. In a fuzzy black-and-white home movie filmed by the neurologist, Milton Wexler had seen more than a dozen villagers wandering woozily on the streets, their limbs shaking uncontrollably. There were scores of Huntington's patients in the village. If Botstein's technique had any chance of working, Nancy Wexler reasoned, she would need to access the genomes of the Venezuelan cohort. It was in Barranquitas, several thousand miles from Los Angeles, that the gene for her family's illness would most likely be found. In the winter of 1979, Wexler set off to Venezuela to hunt the Huntington's gene. There have been a few times in my life when I felt certain that something was really right. Times when I couldn't sit still, Wexler wrote. At first glance, a visitor to Barranquitas might notice nothing unusual about its inhabitants. A man walks by on a dusty road, followed by a band of shirtless children. A thin, dark-haired woman in a floral dress appears from a tin roof shed and makes her way to the market. Two men sit across from each other, conversing and playing cards. The initial impression of normalcy changes quickly. There is something in the man's walk that seems profoundly unnatural. A few steps, and his body begins to move with jerking staccato gestures, while his hand traces sinuous arcs in midair. He twitches and lunges sideways, then corrects himself. Occasionally, his facial muscles contort into a frown. The woman's hands also twist and writhe, tracing airy half-circles around her body. She looks emaciated and drools. She has progressive dementia. One of the two men in conversation flings out his arm violently, then the talk resumes as if nothing has happened. When the Venezuelan neurologist Americo Negret first arrived in Barranquitas in the 1950s, he thought that he had stumbled upon a village of alcoholics. He soon realized that he was wrong. All the men and women with dementia, facial twitches, muscle wasting, and uncontrolled movement had a heritable neurological syndrome, Huntington's disease. In the United States, the syndrome is fleetingly rare. Only 1 in 10,000 have the disease. In some parts of Barranquitas and nearby Lagunetas, in contrast, nearly 1 in 10 or 1 in 20 men and women were afflicted or were carriers of the gene, about 2,000 in total. All have descended from a common ancestor, a woman named Maria Concepcion, a strangely apt name, who conceived the first family that carried the mutant gene to these villages in the 19th century. The disease was so ubiquitous that the locals simply called it El Mal, the evil. Wexler landed in Maracaibo in December 1979. She hired a team of 8 local workers, ventured into the barrios along the lake, and began to document the pedigrees of affected and unaffected men and women. Although trained as a clinical psychologist, Wexler had, by then, become one of the world's leading experts on chorea's and neurodegenerative illnesses. It was an impossible place to conduct research, her assistant recalled. A makeshift ambulatory clinic was set up so that neurologists could identify the patients, characterize the disease, and provide information and supportive care. At first, Wexler's team struggled to find patients with Huntington's disease. The illness was clustered in certain families in certain fishing villages located deep in the swamps. Then, one morning, a local fisherman brought a crucial clue. He knew of a boating shanty about 2 hours along the lake, where several families were afflicted by El Mal. Would Wexler like to venture through the swamps to the village? She would. The next day, Wexler and 2 assistants set off on a boat toward the Pueblo de Agua, the village on stilts. The heat was sweltering. They paddled for hours through the backwaters, and then as they rounded the bend of an inlet, they saw a woman with a brown print dress sitting cross-legged on a porch. The arrival of the boat startled the woman. She rose to go inside the house and was suddenly struck midway by the jerking choretic movements characteristic of Huntington's disease. A continent away from home, Wexler had come face to face with that achingly recognizable dance. It was a clash of total bizarreness and total familiarity, she recalled. I felt connected and alienated. I was overcome. Moments later, as Wexler paddled into the heart of the village, she found another couple lying on a hammock, shaking and dancing violently. There were 14 children, some affected and some carriers. As Wexler collected information about the children and their children, the documented lineage grew rapidly. In a few months, she had established a list containing hundreds of men, women, and children with Huntington's disease. Over the next months, Wexler returned to the sprawl of villages with a team of trained nurses and physicians to collect vial upon vial of blood. The blood was then shipped to the laboratory of James Gusella at the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston and to Michael Connolly, a medical geneticist at Indiana University. In Boston, Gusella purified DNA from blood cells and cut it with a barrage of enzymes, looking for a variant that might be genetically linked to Huntington's disease. Connolly's group analyzed the data to quantify the statistical link between the DNA variants and the disease. The 3-part team expected to plod along slowly. They had to sift through thousands of polymorphic variants, but they were immediately surprised. In 1983, barely 3 years after the blood had arrived, Gusella's team stumbled on a single piece of variant DNA, located on a stretch of chromosome 4, that was strikingly associated with the disease. Notably, Gusella's group had also collected blood from a much smaller American cohort with Huntington's disease. Here, too, the illness associated strongly with a DNA signpost located on chromosome 4. With 2 independent families demonstrating such a powerful association, there could be little doubt about a genetic link. In August 1983, Wexler and Gusella published a paper in Nature definitively mapping the Huntington's disease gene to a distant outpost of chromosome 4, 4P16.3. It was a strange region of the genome, largely barren, with a few unknown genes within it. For the team of geneticists, it was like the sudden landing of a boat on a derelict beachhead, with no known landmarks in sight. To map a gene to its chromosomal location using linkage analysis is to zoom in from outer space into the genetic equivalent of a large metropolitan city. It produces a vastly refined understanding of the location of the gene, but it is still a long way from identifying the gene itself. Next, the gene map is refined by identifying more linkage markers, progressively narrowing the location of a gene to smaller and yet smaller chunks of the chromosome. Districts and subdistricts whiz by. Neighborhoods and blocks appear. The final steps are improbably laborious. The piece of the chromosome carrying the suspected culprit gene is divided into parts and subparts. Each of these parts is isolated from human cells, inserted into yeast or bacterial chromosomes to make millions of copies and thereby cloned. These cloned pieces are sequenced and analyzed, and the sequenced fragments scanned to determine if they contain a potential gene. The process is repeated and refined, every fragment sequenced and rechecked, until a piece of the candidate gene has been identified in a single DNA fragment. The ultimate test is to sequence the gene in normal and affected patients to confirm that the fragment is altered in patients with the hereditary illness. It is like moving door to door to identify a culprit. On a bleak February morning in 1993, James Gasella received an email from his senior postdoc with a single word in it, bingo. It signaled an arrival, a landing. Since 1983, when Gasella's team had initially mapped the Huntington's gene to chromosome 4, Gasella and a team of 58 scientists had spent the bleakest of decades hunting for the gene on that chromosome. They had tried all sorts of shortcuts to isolate the gene. Nothing had worked. Their initial burst of luck had run out. Frustrated, they had resorted to gene-by-gene plotting. In 1992, they had gradually zeroed in on one gene, initially named IT15. Interesting transcript 15. It was later renamed Huntington. IT15 was found to encode an enormous protein, a biochemical behemoth containing 3,144 amino acids, larger than nearly any other protein in the human body. Insulin has a mere 51 amino acids. That morning in February, Gasella's postdoc had sequenced the IT15 gene in a cohort of normal controls in patients with Huntington's disease. As she counted the bands in the sequencing gel, she found an obvious difference between patients and their unaffected relatives. The candidate gene had been found. Wexler was about to leave for yet another trip to Venezuela to collect samples when Gasella called her. She was overwhelmed. She could not stop weeping. "We've got it! We've got it!" she told an interviewer. "It's been a long day's journey into the night." The function of the Huntington protein is still unknown. The normal protein is found in neurons and in testicular tissue and is required for the development of the brain. The mutation that causes the disease is even more mysterious. The normal gene sequence contains a highly repetitive sequence. C-A-G-C-A-G-C-A-G-C-A-G. A molecular sing-song that stretches for 17 such repeats on average. Some people have 10, while others may have up to 35. The mutation found in Huntington's patients is peculiar. Sickle cell anemia is caused by the alteration of a single amino acid in the protein. In Huntington's disease, the mutation is not an alteration of one amino acid or two, but an increase in the number of repeats from less than 35 in the normal gene to more than 40 in the mutant. The increased number of repeats lengthens the size of the Huntington protein. The longer protein is thought to be shredded into pieces in neurons, and these pieces accumulate in tangled spools inside cells, possibly leading to their death and dysfunction. The origin of this strange molecular stutter, the alteration of a repeat sequence, still remains a mystery. It might be an error made in gene copying. Perhaps the DNA replication enzyme adds extra CAGs to the repetitive stretches, like a child who writes an additional S while spelling Mississippi. A remarkable feature of the inheritance of Huntington's disease is a phenomenon called anticipation. In families with Huntington's disease, the number of repeats gets amplified over generations, resulting in 50 or 60 repeats in the gene. A child having misspelled Mississippi once keeps adding more S's. As the repeats increase, the disease accelerates in severity and onset, affecting younger and younger members. In Venezuela, even boys and girls as young as 12 years old are now afflicted, some of them carrying strings of 70 or 80 repeats. Davis and Botstein's technique of mapping genes based on their physical positions on chromosomes, later called positional cloning, marked a transformative moment in human genetics. In 1989, the technique was used to identify a gene that causes cystic fibrosis, a devastating illness that affects the lungs, pancreas, bile ducts, and intestines. Unlike the mutation that causes Huntington's disease, which is fleetingly rare in most populations, except the unusual cluster of patients in Venezuela, the mutated variant of the cystic fibrosis is common. One in 25 men and women of European descent carries the mutation. Humans with a single copy of the mutant gene are largely asymptomatic. If two such asymptomatic carriers conceive a child, chances are one in four that the child will be born with both mutant genes. The consequence of inheriting two mutant copies of the cystic fibrosis gene can be fatal. Some of the mutations have a nearly 100% penetrance. Until the 1980s, the average lifespan of a child carrying two such mutant alleles was 20 years. That cystic fibrosis has something to do with salt and secretions had been suspected for centuries. In 1857, a Swiss almanac for children's songs and games warned about the health of a child whose brow tastes salty when kissed. Children with the disease were known to secrete such enormous quantities of salt through their sweat glands that their sweat-drenched clothes, hung on wires to dry, would corrode the metal like seawater. The secretions of the lung were so viscous that they blocked the airways with gobs of mucus. The phlegm-clogged airways became breeding grounds for bacteria, causing frequent lethal pneumonias, among the most common causes of death. It was a horrific life, a body drowning in its own secretions, that often culminated in a horrific death. In 1595, a professor of anatomy at Leiden wrote of a child's death. Inside the pericardium, the heart was floating in a poisonous liquid, sea green in color. Death had been caused by the pancreas, which was oddly swollen. The little girl was very thin, worn out by hectic fever, a fluctuating but persistent fever. It is virtually certain that he was describing a case of cystic fibrosis. In 1985, Lapchi Choi, a human geneticist working in Toronto, found an anonymous marker, one of Botstein's DNA variants along the genome, that was linked to the mutant cystic fibrosis gene. The marker was quickly pinpointed on chromosome 7, but the cystic fibrosis gene was still lost somewhere in the genetic wilderness of that chromosome. Choi began to hunt for the cystic fibrosis gene by progressively narrowing the region that might contain it. The hunt was joined by Francis Collins, a human geneticist at the University of Michigan, and by Jack Reardon, also in Toronto. Collins had made an ingenious modification to the standard gene-hunting technique. In gene mapping, one usually walked along a chromosome, cloning one bit, then the next, one contiguous overlapping stretch after another. It was painstakingly laborious, like climbing a rope by placing one fist directly upon the other. Collins's method allowed him to move up and down the chromosome with a greatly outstretched reach. He called it chromosome jumping. By the spring of 1989, Collins, Choi, and Reardon had used chromosome jumping to narrow the gene hunt to a few candidates on chromosome 7. The task was now to sequence the genes, confirm their identity, and define the mutation that affected the function of the cystic fibrosis gene. On a rain-drenched evening late that summer, while both Choi and Collins were attending a gene mapping workshop in Bethesda, they stood penitently by a fax machine, waiting for news of the gene sequence from a postdoc researcher in Collins's lab. As the machine spit out sheaves of paper with garbles of sequence, A, T, G, C, C, G, G, T, C, Collins watched the revelation materialize out of thin air. Only one gene was persistently mutated in both copies in affected children, while their unaffected parents carried a single copy of the mutation. The cystic fibrosis gene codes a molecule that channels salt across cellular membranes. The most common mutation is a deletion of three bases of DNA that results in the removal or deletion of just one amino acid from the protein. In the language of genes, three bases of DNA encode a single amino acid. This deletion creates a dysfunctional protein that is unable to move chloride, one component of sodium chloride, that is, common salt, across membranes. The salt in sweat cannot be absorbed back into the body, resulting in the characteristically salty sweat. Nor can the body secrete salt and water into the intestines, resulting in the abdominal symptoms. The cloning of the cystic fibrosis gene was a landmark achievement for human geneticists. Within a few months, a diagnostic test for the mutant allele became available. By the early 1990s, carriers could be screened for the mutation, and the disease could routinely be diagnosed in utero, allowing parents to consider aborting affected fetuses or to monitor children for early manifestations of the disease. Carrier couples, in which both parents happen to possess at least one copy of the mutant gene, could choose not to conceive a child or to adopt children. Over the last decade, the combination of targeted parental screening and fetal diagnosis has reduced the prevalence of children born with cystic fibrosis by about 30-40% in populations where the frequency of the mutant allele is the highest. In 1993, a New York hospital launched an aggressive program to screen Ashkenazi Jews for three genetic diseases, including cystic fibrosis, Gaucher's disease, and Tay-Sachs disease. Mutations in these genes are more prevalent in the Ashkenazi population. Parents could freely choose to be screened to undergo amniocentesis for prenatal diagnosis and to terminate a pregnancy if the fetus was found to be affected. Since the launch of the program, not a single baby with any of these genetic diseases has been born at that hospital. It is important to conceptualize the transformation in genetics that occurred between 1971, the year that Berg and Jackson created the first molecule of recombinant DNA, and 1993, the year that the Huntington's disease gene was definitively isolated. Even though DNA had been identified as the master molecule of genetics by the late 1950s, no means then existed to sequence, synthesize, alter, or manipulate it. Aside from a few notable exceptions, the genetic basis of human disease was largely unknown. Only a few human diseases, sickle cell anemia, thalassemia, and hemophilia B, had been definitively mapped to their causal genes. The only human genetic interventions available clinically were amniocentesis and abortion. Insulin and clotting factors were being isolated from pig organs and human blood. No medicine had been created by genetic engineering. A human gene had never intentionally been expressed outside a human cell. The prospect of changing an organism's genome by introducing foreign genes, or by deliberately mutating its native genes, was far outside the reach of any technology. The word biotechnology did not exist in the Oxford Dictionary. Two decades later, the transformation of the landscape of genetics was remarkable. Human genes had been mapped, isolated, sequenced, synthesized, cloned, recombined, introduced into bacterial cells, shuttled into viral genomes, and used to create medicines. As the physicist and historian Evelyn Fox Keller described it, once molecular biologists had discovered techniques by which they themselves could manipulate DNA, there emerged a technological know-how that decisively altered our historical sense of the immutability of nature. Where the traditional view had been that nature spelt destiny and nurture freedom, now the roles appeared to be reversed. We could more readily control the former, that is, genes, than the latter, that is, the environment, not simply as a long-term goal, but as an immediate prospect. In 1969, on the eve of the revelatory decade, Robert Sensheimer, the geneticist, wrote an essay about the future. The capacity to synthesize, sequence, and manipulate genes would unveil a new horizon in the history of man. Some may smile and may feel that this is but a new version of the old dream of the perfection of man. It is that, but it is something more. The old dreams of the cultural perfections of man were always sharply constrained by his inherent, inherited imperfections and limitations. We now glimpse another route, the chance to ease and consciously perfect far beyond our present vision this remarkable product of 2 billion years of evolution. Other scientists, anticipating this biological revolution, had been less sanguine about it. As the geneticist J.B.S. Haldane had described it in 1923, once the power to control genes had been harnessed, no beliefs, no values, no institutions are safe. To get the genome. Our ability to read out this sequence of our own genome has the makings of a philosophical paradox. Can an intelligent being comprehend the instructions to make itself? John Sulston. Scholars of Renaissance shipbuilding have often debated the nature of the technology that spurred the explosive growth of transoceanic navigation in the late 1400s and 1500s, ultimately leading to the discovery of the New World. Was it the capacity to build larger ships, galleons, carracks, and flutes, as one camp insists? Or was it the invention of new navigation technologies, a superior astrolabe, the navigator's compass, and the early sextant? In the history of science and technology, too, breakthroughs seem to come in two fundamental forms, There are scale shifts, where the crucial advance emerges as a result of an alteration of size or scale alone. The moon rocket, as one engineer famously pointed out, was just a massive jet plane pointed vertically at the moon. And there are conceptual shifts in which the advance arises because of the emergence of a radical new concept or idea. In truth, the two modes are not mutually exclusive, but reinforcing. Scale shifts enable conceptual shifts, and new concepts in turn demand new scales. The microscope opened a door to a subvisual world. Cells and intracellular organelles were revealed, raising questions about the inner anatomy and physiology of a cell, and demanding yet more powerful microscopes to understand the structures and functions of these subcellular compartments. Between the mid-1970s and the mid-1980s, genetics had witnessed many conceptual shifts: gene cloning, gene mapping, split genes, genetic engineering, and new modes of gene regulation, but no radical shifts in scale. Over the decade, hundreds of individual genes had been isolated, sequenced, and cloned by virtue of functional characteristics, but no comprehensive catalog of all genes of a cellular organism existed. In principle, the technology to sequence an entire organismal genome had been invented, but the sheer size of the effort had made scientists balk. In 1977, when Fred Sanger had sequenced the genome of the Fei Chi virus with 5,386 bases of DNA, that number represented the outer limit of gene sequencing capability. The human genome contains 3,095,677,412 base pairs, representing a scale shift of 574,000-fold. The potential benefit of a comprehensive sequencing effort was particularly highlighted by the isolation of disease-linked genes in humans. Even as the mapping and identification of crucial human genes was being celebrated in the popular press in the early 1990s, geneticists and patients were privately voicing concerns about the inefficiency and laboriousness of the process. For Huntington's disease, it had taken no less than 25 years to move from one patient, Nancy Wexler's mother, to the gene, 121 years if you count Huntington's original case history of the disease. Hereditary forms of breast cancer had been known since antiquity, yet the most common breast cancer-associated gene, BRCA1, was only identified in 1994. Even with new technologies such as chromosome jumping that had been used to isolate the cystic fibrosis gene, finding and mapping genes was frustratingly slow. There was no shortage of exceptionally clever people trying to find genes in the human, John Sulston, the worm biologist, noted. But they were wasting their time theorizing about the bits of the sequence that might be necessary. The gene-by-gene approach, Sulston feared, would eventually come to a standstill. James Watson echoed the frustration with the pace of single-gene genetics. But even with the immense power of recombinant DNA methodologies, he argued, the eventual isolation of most disease genes still seemed in the mid-1980s beyond human capability. What Watson sought was the sequence of the entire human genome, all 3 billion base pairs of it, starting with the first nucleotide and ending with the last. Every known human gene, including all of its genetic code, all the regulatory sequences, every intron and exon, and all the long stretches of DNA between genes and all protein coding segments, would be found in that sequence. The sequence would act as a template for the annotation of genes discovered in the future. If a geneticist found a novel gene that increases the risk for breast cancer, for instance, she should be able to decipher its precise location and sequence by mapping it to the master sequence of the human genome. And the sequence would also be the normal template against which abnormal genes, i.e. mutations, could be annotated, by comparing that breast cancer-associated gene between affected and unaffected women, the geneticist would be able to map the mutation responsible for causing the disease. Impetus for sequencing the entire human genome came from two other sources. The one-gene-at-a-time approach worked perfectly for monogenetic diseases, such as cystic fibrosis and Huntington's disease, but most common human diseases do not arise from single-gene mutations. These are not genetic illnesses as much as genomic illnesses. Multiple genes, spread diffusely throughout the human genome, determine the risk for the illness. These diseases cannot be understood through the action of a single gene, They can only be understood, diagnosed, or predicted by understanding the interrelationships between several independent genes. The archetypal genomic disease is cancer. That cancer is a disease of genes had been known for more than a century. In 1872, Hilario de Gouveia, a Brazilian ophthalmologist, had described a family in which a rare form of eye cancer, called retinoblastoma, coursed tragically through multiple generations. Families certainly share much more than genes, bad habits, bad recipes, neuroses, obsessions, environments, and behaviors, but the familial pattern of the illness suggested a genetic cause. Dr. Gouveia proposed an inherited factor as the cause of these rare eye tumors. Halfway across the globe and 7 years prior, an unknown botanist monk named Mendel had published a paper on inherited factors in peas, but de Gouveia had never encountered Mendel's paper or the word gene. By the late 1970s, a full century after de Gouveia, scientists began to converge on the uncomfortable realization that cancers arose from normal cells that had acquired mutations in growth-controlling genes. In normal cells, these genes act as powerful regulators of growth. Hence, a wound in the skin, having healed itself, typically stops healing and does not morph into a tumor. Or, in the language of genetics, genes tell the cells in a wound when to start growing and when to stop. In cancer cells, geneticists realized, these pathways were somehow disrupted. Start genes were jammed on and stop genes were flicked off. Genes that altered metabolism and identity of a cell were corrupted, resulting in a cell that did not know how to stop growing. That cancer was the result of alterations of such endogenous genetic pathways, a distorted version of our normal selves, as Harold Varmus, the cancer biologist, put it, was ferociously disquieting. For decades, scientists had hoped that some pathogen, such as a virus or bacterium, would be implicated as the universal cause of cancer and might potentially be eliminated via a vaccine or antimicrobial therapy. The intimacy of the relationship between cancer genes and normal genes threw open a central challenge of cancer biology. How might the mutant genes be restored to their off or on states while allowing normal growth to proceed unperturbed? This was, and still remains, the defining goal, the perennial fantasy, and the deepest conundrum of cancer therapy. Normal cells could acquire these cancer-causing mutations through four mechanisms. The mutations could be caused by environmental insults, such as tobacco smoke, ultraviolet light, or X-rays, agents that attack DNA and change its chemical structure. Mutations could arise from spontaneous errors during cell division. Every time DNA is replicated in a cell, there's a minor chance that the copying process generates an error. An A switched to a T, G, or C, say. Mutant cancer genes could be inherited from parents, thereby causing hereditary cancer syndromes such as retinoblastoma and breast cancer that course through families. Or the genes could be carried into the cells via viruses, the professional gene carriers and gene swappers of the microbial world. In all four cases, the result converged on the same pathological process, the inappropriate activation or inactivation of genetic pathways that controlled growth, causing the malignant, dysregulated cellular division that was characteristic of cancer. That one of the most elemental diseases in human history happens to arise from the corruption of the two most elemental processes in biology is not a coincidence. Cancer co-opts the logic of both evolution and heredity. It is a pathological convergence of Mendel and Darwin. Cancer cells arise via mutation, survival, natural selection, and growth, and they transmit the instructions for malignant growth to their daughter cells via their genes. As biologists realized in the early 1980s, cancer then was a new kind of genetic disease, the result of heredity, evolution, environment, and chance all mixed together. But how many such genes were involved in causing a typical human cancer? One gene per cancer? A dozen? 100? In the late 1990s at Johns Hopkins University, a cancer geneticist named Bert Vogelstein decided to create a comprehensive catalog of nearly all the genes implicated in human cancers. Vogelstein had already discovered that cancers arise from a step-by-step process involving the accumulation of dozens of mutations in a cell. Gene by gene, a cell slouches toward cancer, acquiring one, two, four, and then dozens of mutations that tip its physiology from controlled growth to dysregulated growth. To cancer geneticists, these data clearly suggested that the one gene at a time approach would be insufficient to understand, diagnose, or treat cancer. A fundamental feature of cancer was its enormous genetic diversity. Two specimens of breast cancer removed from two breasts of the same woman at the same time might have vastly different spectra of mutations, and thereby behave differently, progress at different rates, and respond to different chemotherapies. To understand cancer, biologists would need to assess the entire genome of a cancer cell. If the sequencing of cancer genomes, not just individual cancer genes, was necessary to understand the physiology and diversity of cancers, then it was all the more evident that the sequence of the normal genome had to be completed first. The human genome forms the normal counterpart to the cancer genome. A genetic mutation can be described only in the context of a normal or wild-type counterpart. Without that template of normalcy, one had little hope that the fundamental biology of cancer could be solved. Like cancer, heritable mental illnesses were also turning out to involve dozens of genes. Schizophrenia, in particular, sparked a furor of national attention in 1984 when James Huberty, a man known to have paranoid hallucinations, strolled casually into a McDonald's in San Diego on a July afternoon and shot and killed 21 people. The day before the massacre, Huberty had left a desperate message with a receptionist at a mental health clinic, pleading for help, then waited for hours by his phone. The return phone call never came. The receptionist had mistakenly spelled his name Schauberty and neglected to copy his number. The next morning, still afloat in a paranoid fugue, he had left home with a loaded semi-automatic wrapped in a checkered blanket, having told his daughter that he was going hunting humans. The Huberty catastrophe occurred 7 months after an enormous National Academy of Sciences, NAS, study published data definitively linking schizophrenia to genetic causes. Using the twin method pioneered by Galton in the 1890s and by Nazi geneticists in the 1940s, the NAS study found that identical twins possessed a striking 30-40% concordance rate for schizophrenia. An earlier study, published by the geneticist Irving Gottesman in 1982, had found an even more provocative correlation of between 40-60% in identical twins. If one twin was diagnosed with schizophrenia, then the chance of the other twin developing the illness was 50 times higher than the risk of schizophrenia in the general population. For identical twins with the severest form of schizophrenia, Gottesman had found the concordance rate was 75-90%. Nearly every identical twin with one of the severest variants of schizophrenia had been found to have a twin with the same illness. This high degree of concordance between identical twins suggested a powerful genetic influence on schizophrenia. But notably, both the NAS and the Gottesman study found that the concordance rate fell sharply between non-identical twins, to about 10%. To a geneticist, such a pattern of inheritance offers important clues about the underlying genetic influences on an illness. Suppose schizophrenia is caused by a single dominant, highly penetrant mutation in one gene. If one identical twin inherits that mutant gene, then the other will invariably inherit that gene. Both will manifest the disease, and the concordance between the twins should approach 100%. Fraternal twins and siblings should, on average, inherit that gene about half of the time, and the concordance between them should fall to 50%. In contrast, suppose schizophrenia is not one disease, but a family of diseases. Imagine that the cognitive apparatus of the brain is a complex mechanical engine, composed of a central axle, a main gearbox, and dozens of smaller pistons and gaskets to regulate and fine-tune its activity. If the main axle breaks and the gearbox snaps, then the entire cognition engine collapses. This is analogous to the severe variant of schizophrenia, a combination of a few highly penetrant mutations in genes that control neural communication and development might cause the axle and the gears to collapse, resulting in severe deficits of cognition. Since identical twins inherit identical genomes, both will invariably inherit mutations in the axle and the gearbox genes. And since the mutations are highly penetrant, the concordance between identical twins will still approach 100%. But now imagine that the cognition engine can also malfunction if several of the smaller gaskets, spark plugs, and pistons, do not work. In this case, the engine does not fully collapse, it sputters and gasps, and its dysfunction is more situational. It worsens in the winter. This, by analogy, is the milder variant of schizophrenia. The malfunction is caused by a combination of mutations, each with low penetrance. These are gasket and piston and spark plug genes, exerting more subtle control on the overall mechanism of cognition. Here, too, identical twins possessing identical genomes will inherit, say, all five variants of the genes together. But since the penetrance is incomplete and the triggers more situational, the concordance between identical twins might fall to only 30 or 50%. Fraternal twins and siblings, in contrast, will share only a few of these gene variants. Mendel's laws guarantee that all five variants will rarely be inherited in toto by two siblings. The concordance between fraternal twins and siblings will fall even more sharply, to 5 or 10%. This pattern of inheritance is more commonly observed in schizophrenia. That identical twins share only a 50% concordance, that is, if one twin is affected, then the other twin is affected only 50% of the time, clearly demonstrates that some other triggers, environmental factors or chance events, are required to tip the predisposition over an edge. But when a child of a schizophrenic parent is adopted at birth by a non-schizophrenic family, the child still has a 15 to 20% risk of developing the illness, about 20-fold higher than the general population, demonstrating that the genetic influences can be powerful and autonomous despite enormous variations in environments. These patterns strongly suggest that schizophrenia is a complex polygenic illness involving multiple variants, multiple genes, and potential environmental or chance triggers. As with cancer and other polygenic diseases, then, a gene-by-gene approach is unlikely to unlock the physiology of schizophrenia. Populist anxieties about genes, mental illness, and crime were fanned further with the publication in the summer of 1985 of Crime and Human Nature, The Definitive Study of the Causes of Crime, an incendiary book written by James Q. Wilson, a political scientist, and Richard Herrnstein, a behavioral biologist. Wilson and Herrnstein argued that particular forms of mental illness, most notably schizophrenia, especially in its violent disruptive form, were highly prevalent among criminals, likely to be genetically ingrained, and likely to be the cause of criminal behavior. Addiction and violence also had strong genetic components. The hypothesis seized popular imagination. Post-war academic criminology had been dominated by environmental theories of crime. That is, criminals were the products of bad influences, bad friends, bad neighborhoods, bad labels. Wilson and Herrnstein acknowledged these factors, but added the most controversial fourth, bad genes. The soil was not contaminated, they suggested. The seed was. Crime and Human Nature steamrolled into a major media phenomenon. 20 major news outlets, the New York Times, Newsweek, and Science among them, reviewed or featured it. Time reinforced its essential message in its headline, "Are criminals born, not made?" Newsweek's byline was more blunt, "Criminals born and bred." Wilson and Herrnstein's book was met with a barrage of criticism. Even diehard believers of the genetic theory of schizophrenia had to admit that the etiology of the illness was largely unknown, that acquired influences had to play a major triggering role, hence the 50 not 100% concordance among identical twins, and that the vast majority of schizophrenics lived in the terrifying shadow of their illness, but had no history of criminality whatsoever. But to a public frothing with concern about violence and crime in the 80s, the idea that the human genome might contain the answers not just to medical illnesses, but to social maladies such as deviance, alcoholism, violence, moral corruption, perversion, or addiction, was potently seductive. In an interview in the Baltimore Sun, a neurosurgeon wondered if the crime-prone, such as Huberty, could be identified, quarantined, and treated before they had committed crimes, i.e., via genetic profiling of pre-criminals. A psychiatric geneticist commented on the impact that identifying such genes might have on the public discourse around crime, responsibility, and punishment. The link to genetics is quite clear. We would be naive not to think that one aspect of curing crime will be biological. Set against this monumental backdrop of hype and expectation, The first conversations to approach human genome sequencing were remarkably deflating. In the summer of 1984, Charles DeLisi, a science administrator from the Department of Energy, DOE, convened a meeting of experts to evaluate the technical feasibility of human genome sequencing. Since the early 1980s, DOE researchers had been investigating the effects of radiation on human genes. The Hiroshima-Nagasaki bombings of 1945 had sprayed hundreds of thousands of Japanese citizens with varying doses of radiation, including 12,000 surviving children, now in their 40s and 50s. How many mutations had occurred in these children, in what genes, and over what time? Since radiation-induced mutations would likely be randomly scattered through the genome, a gene-by-gene search would be futile. In December 1984, another meeting of scientists was called to evaluate whether whole genome sequencing might be used to detect genetic alterations in radiation-exposed children. The conference was held at Alta in Utah, the same mountain town where Botstein and Davis had originally conceived the idea of mapping human genes using linkage and polymorphisms. On the surface, the Alta meeting was a spectacular failure. Scientists realized that the sequencing technology available in the mid-1980s was nowhere close to being able to map mutations across a human genome. But the meeting was a crucial platform to jumpstart a conversation about comprehensive gene sequencing. A fleet of meetings on genome sequencing followed, in Santa Cruz in May 1985, and in Santa Fe in March 1986. In the late summer of 1986, James Watson convened perhaps the most decisive of these meetings at Cold Spring Harbor, provocatively titling it The Molecular Biology of Homo Sapiens. As with Asilomar, the serenity of the campus, on a placid crystalline bay with rolling hills tipping into the water, contrasted with the fervent energy of the discussions. A host of new studies was presented at the meeting that suddenly made genome sequencing seem within technological reach. The most important technical breakthrough, perhaps, came from Carrie Mullis, a biochemist studying gene replication. To sequence genes, it is crucial to have enough starting material of DNA. A single bacterial cell can be grown into hundreds of millions of cells, thereby supplying abundant amounts of bacterial DNA for sequencing. But it is difficult to grow hundreds of millions of human cells. Mullis had discovered an ingenious shortcut. He made a copy of a human gene in a test tube using DNA polymerase, then used that copy to make copies of the copy, then copied the multiple copies for dozens of cycles. Each cycle of copying amplified the DNA, resulting in an exponential increase in the yield of a gene. The technique was eventually called the polymerase chain reaction, or PCR, and would become crucial for the Human Genome Project. Eric Lander, a mathematician turned biologist, told the audience about new mathematical methods to find genes related to complex, multigenic diseases. Leroy Hood from Caltech described a semi-automated machine that could speed up Sanger's sequencing method by 10 or 20-fold. Earlier, Walter Gilbert, the DNA sequencing pioneer, had prepared an edge-of-napkin calculation of the costs and personnel involved. To sequence all 3 billion base pairs of human DNA, Gilbert estimated, would take about 50,000 person-years and cost around $3 billion, $1 per base. As Gilbert, with characteristic panache, strode across the floor to inscribe the number on a chalkboard, an intense debate broke out in the audience. Gilbert's number, which would turn out to be startlingly accurate, had reduced the Genome Project to tangible realities. Indeed, put in perspective, the cost was not even particularly large. At its peak, the Apollo program had employed nearly 400,000 people, with a total cumulative cost of about $100 billion. If Gilbert was right, the human genome could be had for less than 1/30th of the moon landing. Sidney Brenner later joked that the sequencing of the human genome would perhaps ultimately be limited not by cost or technology, but only by the severe monotony of its labor. Perhaps, he speculated, genome sequencing should be doled out as a punishment to criminals and convicts, 1 million bases for robbery, 2 million for homicide, 10 million for murder. As dusk fell on the bay that evening, Watson spoke to several scientists about an unfolding personal crisis of his. On May 27th, the night before the conference, his 15-year-old son, Rufus Watson, had escaped from a psychiatric facility in White Plains.